You know, you're waiting all day, you get up to the front of the line, and there's some messed up paperwork, and bam.
I presented my credentials to the Secretary of the Senate and advised that my credentials were not in order and I would not be accepted, nor would I be seated, nor would I be permitted on the floor.
Roland Burris ran into a paperwork buzzsaw as he tried to claim his seat in the Senate. In Illinois, there's one way of doing things, and then there's the U.S. Senate. Sticklers for details on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, January 7th. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora.
Good morning, everyone. The latest on Gaza. Israel has called for a lull in its offensive, we'll explain. And Freakonomics author Stephen Dubner explains why you're probably afraid of the wrong things. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
Israeli attacks on Hamas in Gaza are paused for the moment. This is to allow humanitarian supplies into the territory. Israel plans to stop attacks for 3 hours each afternoon. That leaves about an hour left in today's pause. There's been heavy criticism of Israel for civilian deaths in Gaza. An estimated 300 civilians are dead out of a total death toll of nearly 700. There's also the possibility of a larger joint ceasefire. A French-Egyptian plan is apparently gaining momentum. It's got the support of the Palestinian president. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is intrigued, but says it must end Hamas rocket launchings.
The situation before the current events in Gaza was clearly not sustainable. Hundreds of thousands of Israelis lived under the daily threat of rocket attack.
But those rocket launches into Israel have fallen off since the Israeli assault began on Gaza, but they've not completely stopped. Full details of the ceasefire plan aren't public.
More now on Illinois Senate appointee Roland Burris. He's scheduled to meet with Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid today. He was not allowed to be sworn in with the other senators yesterday, but Reid has hinted at the possibility of a deal that would ultimately seat Burris. Winter winds are whipping through Europe, but not natural gas for heaters. The Russian natural supply, the gas line to Europe, have been cut off. Many countries in Europe get gas from Russia through Ukraine, but Russia and Ukraine have been in an energy fight for a while, and they're blaming each other for the European shutdown.
$136 billion, that's Defense Secretary Robert Gates' estimate of the yearly cost of the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. He's asking Congress for an additional $70 billion. Very special lunch today at the White House. President-elect Obama will join all the living U.S. presidents, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George H.W. Bush, and Jimmy Carter. Barack Obama asked for the lunch, and there'll be a special pre-luncheon with just George W. and Barack Obama. The Dow gained nearly 0.75% yesterday, ending at 90.15. The S&P starts trading today at 9.34. We're looking for a playlist. Apparently, you can correlate rhythm and dark economic times. The more the music is danceable, the worse it is for economic conditions. Do you buy that? Well, we're looking for some kind of a playlist that is scientifically going to get us out of this economic malaise. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with the crisis in Gaza. And on one level, it's an act of mercy. But on another, it's another grim sign of the mechanics of what's gone on in Gaza for nearly a week now. There is a break in the bloodshed at this hour. Israel has ordered a pause in its offensive to allow food and fuel to reach Palestinians. The military says it's considering similar lulls in the coming days. And Israel is trying to determine whether it should accept an international ceasefire that's now being floated by France and Egypt or step up its assault against Hamas in Gaza. Joining us now with the details live from Jerusalem is Gwen Ackerman, a reporter for Bloomberg News. There's a whole lot there. The pause to allow aid into Gaza, this ceasefire, the details of which aren't well known. What do you think is the lead headline at this point?
It's hard to tell. I think we can be more optimistic that there might be a ceasefire in coming days as we see this temporary three-hour ceasefire in Gaza, allowing people to go out and get food. We do have the president of Israel, Shimon Peres, saying today that it will take some days for them to study the ceasefire proposals put forward by Egypt and France.
We've heard details that possibly a way of moving this forward would be to allow Fatah to guard the border post at Rafah on the border with Egypt, and that that might be a face-saving way for both the Palestinians and Hamas to get out of this.
Should Egypt take control of Rafah?
No. Should Fatah help to guard the border post at Rafah so there would be some sort of joint security arrangement between Hamas and Fatah? Have you heard anything about that?
At this point, the only people I've heard talking about that are analysts. I have not heard any official proposal of that sort at all. Their analysts are putting forward that as a possible solution. However, I have not heard at all anything official about that.
What is the missile count from Gaza via Hamas fighters today? It certainly declined precipitously in the last week, but any sense of how much that's been curtailed?
Israel says that they have curtailed Hamas's ability to shoot rockets at the country. Difficult to say because every day we have different numbers of rockets. The most rockets fired at Israel did come in the beginning of the operation. However, we still have tens of rockets being shot at Israel, so it's hard to say how much of their ability has been curtailed for sure at this point.
And it seems fairly clear that getting down to zero is sort of the sine qua non for real negotiations over a ceasefire. Tell us about the aid that's being directed into Gaza during these three-hour pauses.
Israel's been allowing aid in trucks, up to 100 a day it's allowed in during the course of this operation. The main problem was that because of the air raids, because of now the ground forces on the ground fighting Hamas, residents couldn't go out even to the warehouses to even get that aid. So what's happening today is because there's a ceasefire, because Hamas and Israel said no shooting, people feel safe enough to go out and get the food and the medicines that they need for their families and water, I think, as well.
Gwen Ackerman, final question. This is possibly the first moment for Israelis to blink and kind of look forward to February 10th, when the elections will be. What is the sense of what the government has gained or lost here in this initiative?
We are seeing actually calls for the elections to be delayed because of this initiative. At the same time, it does not appear that Tzipi Livni, who is running at the head of the Kadima Party, which is the ruling party now, is actually losing very much by running this operation. The main winner out of it at this point looks like Defense Minister Ehud Barak, who leads the Labor Party. And in the most recent polls, we've seen him gaining seats as opposed to before the conflict.
So that, on balance, argues positively for Kadima and a left-center coalition, correct?
It could, but it's way too early to say.
Way too early to say. Well, Gwen Ackerman, a reporter for Bloomberg News in Jerusalem with the big picture. Let's remind you, there is a break in the bloodshed in Gaza at this hour. Israel has ordered a daily pause in its offensive to allow food and fuel to reach Palestinians. And Israel is considering an international ceasefire plan from France and Egypt. Gwen, thanks for joining us.
As for conditions in Gaza at the moment, the International Committee of the Red Cross has described them as having reached a full-blown crisis. For one personal perspective, we spoke earlier to Dr. Ron Lobel, medical director of the Barzilai Hospital, which is located in Israel about 10 miles from the border with Gaza. And I asked Dr. Lobel if he agreed that the situation had grown to a humanitarian crisis.
I have no doubt. The medical system in Gaza, I'm sure, has collapsed already several days ago. Knowing very well the facilities there, I'm sure they are insufficient to treat such a large number of casualties.
And so how would you describe what's happening not only at your hospital, but around you, given where you are right at the Gaza border?
I can tell we are in a 500-bed hospital, governmental hospital, at 12 kilometers from the border with Gaza. On a normal day, we receive many patients from Gaza. We treat injured patients and sick patients from Gaza. But since that operation, the Israeli operation started, no patient has come from Gaza. We still have several children and adults hospitalized here from prior to the clashes. As a matter of fact, yesterday, one of the mothers that accompanies a child in our pediatric unit, a Palestinian woman, gave birth to her daughter here at the hospital. From where I live in a very small rural community. My house is 300 meters from the border. I can see the fighting going on. We are observing it with a lot of pain and looking at the pictures from the windows and at the television. They are horrible pictures. But then again, my house has been bombarded for the last 8 years with Qassam missiles. As a matter of fact, 4 Grad missiles exploded in Ashkelon around the hospital during the last 10, 15 minutes. So we hope things will end as soon as possible. I know that there's a temporary ceasefire now and that humanitarian aid is being brought into Gaza. Maybe it will help both sides to relax for a moment and think how we can end that conflict.
Well, Dr. Lobel, you have a relationship with Shifa Hospital in Gaza that goes back a long way. How frustrating is it for you that the relationship of resupply and patient sharing and doctor sharing actually gets interrupted at times like these when the fighting breaks out?
It's very frustrating because we have many friends and colleagues in Gaza, and as I said, we are on a daily basis relationship with them. We talk to them very often. We meet with them quite often. Till Hamas came into power, there were more than 130 joint projects in health between Israel and Palestinians. All those almost all these projects stopped after Hamas went into power. As I said, we still treat patients from Gaza when there are not active clashes with on the border and when the Erez Gate is open.
At your hospital now, are you actually treating any of the Israeli soldiers who are involved in the offensive?
Yes. From the beginning of the ground operation, we received already more than 60 injured soldiers. Most of them were treated at the hospital and then sent home. Some were sent back to the battlefield if their situation allowed it. About 8 soldiers are still in the hospital, and they have to go through surgical operations.
And so what are if there is a lull today, what do you think some of the priorities are going to be for those resources that are going to be let into Gaza?
I believe that first of all they have to supply food to the people there, and of course medication, all the supplies that are needed for the hospital. I hope they are on their way into Gaza.
Dr. Lobel, thank you so much for joining us.
Just one more word. We consider our Palestinians across the border not as enemies. We consider them as neighbors, and we are supposed to live with them for the coming centuries. Our problem is not with the Palestinians. Our problem is with the Hamas that pushes them forward to shooting Qassam and Grad missiles into our house and homes.
That was Dr. Ron Lobel, the medical director of Barzilai Hospital in Israel near the Gaza border, and that was in an interview recorded earlier this morning.
Well, you can hear the sense of contradictions between the being vulnerable to missiles and also seeing the vulnerability of the people in Gaza.
Certainly tough.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. All right, let's say you're going on a trip and you're on your way to the airport. Do you think about the drunk driver that just might veer into your lane and kill you? No, you probably don't. You get to the airport, you get on the plane, you sit down, maybe you're a little bit nervous. You overhear a conversation of some people next to you. Are you getting a little more nervous? Are you starting to fear?
Everyone just assumes that we're Muslims, we're terrorists, sure, we're up to something. Every time we walk into the plane, that's kind of the regular stare we get from everybody.
Well, on New Year's Day this year, 9 people, including 3 young children, were removed from a flight headed to Orlando from Reagan National Airport in D.C. 8 of the 9 passengers were U.S.-born American citizens, but they were also Muslims, and 2 other passengers overheard what they thought was a suspicious remark, and the airline responded by kicking the family off the flight. Yet on New Year's Eve and Christmas Eve, 2 white American men planned and executed rampages without anyone suspecting anything in Aspen, Colorado. A series of homemade bombs forcing the evacuation of most of the downtown. And in the L.A. area, a man killed 9 people at a Christmas party in a hail of bullets and flames. So what are you afraid of, and what scares you, and what is actually likely to hurt you? It's a job for Stephen Dubner. He's co-author of the book Freakonomics and writer of the blog. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
I tried to set up that premise. You know, what scares me is different from what's likely to hurt me. Help me out with this.
I think you set it up. I think my work here is done. Well, it turns out that human beings, for reasons that are probably pretty hard to understand, really, although a lot of people are trying, are really bad at risk assessment, okay? So we tend to fear the big, rare events, disaster preparedness, people call it the low probability, high consequence events, things that are very unlikely to happen. But if they do, it's really bad. Whereas the things that we should fear more, or at least take care of more, we just don't. Why our brains do that is a really interesting question that really has to be left to smarter people than I. It has to do with, you know, heuristics, these shortcuts about the way we think, the way we make decisions, especially in a short period of time. One thing I can tell you is this. It's probably pretty obvious to you guys and everybody listening to the show, but it's good to remind ourselves of it. The way our brain works when we need to make a decision is we call up our bank of information to make these shortcut decisions. And the things that tend to stick to our brains well are anomalies, okay? The big, weird, high-consequence, low-probability events that make the news.
And horrible pictures. Freakish events.
The freakish events, the outliers, the things that are not common. The reason – here's what – I remember the very – when I studied journalism in college, the best thing I learned was the first day I sat down, the professor said, the root of news is new. People tend to forget that. If it's not new, for the most part, it won't be in the news. Now, politics gets covered all the time, but mostly what the news is a catalog of things that have not happened before. Therefore, they're presented in this dramatic way. Therefore, our brains suck them in. They sit there in our read-only memory waiting for some recall. But we forget that they're anomalous events and not typical events.
So is that to say our brains are processing the fact that while plane crashes are still as horrible as they are, always have been, they're less new than terrorist attacks on airplanes?
Yeah, absolutely. So when there's the big rare event, we tend to, you know, make it almost a normative event and think of it, you know, in totally the wrong way. So in other words, you know, one way to look at it, here's a totally different take on it, something that I've been thinking about a little bit lately. The last several years have been bad years for financial fraud. There's been a lot going on, Bernie Madoff being one example, but there being many examples, and not just fraud, but kind of finance gone wrong, where theoretically, more regulation from law enforcement might have done better.
We've heard of this. Yes.
You could make the argument that one of the reasons that regulation has been so lax, or not even regulation, but enforcement has been so lax, is because there was so much attention diverted to a different kind of crime, which was terrorism, right? Hmm. So after 9/11, you've got, and even within the FBI, now there's been some journalism on this, there should probably be a lot more. After 9/11, a lot of resources, manpower, money, attention, mind capital was diverted to taking care of the big rare threat. Right. Now, here's the thing, though. You can't say, well, we shouldn't worry about terrorism. It happened. 9/11 was a big, rare event. It was a black swan. We shouldn't worry about it again. You can't say that. Well, the problem is we can't measure how well the deterrence may have worked. Well,
but just on a simple, to get back to your example, the person you know is far more likely to hurt you than the person you don't know. And that's just one of those basic fundamental facts that we hear over and over. But that doesn't seem to sink in.
It doesn't.
Do you want to just talk about that in relationship to the two examples?
I'll give a few examples of exactly. We fear strangers when – I'm not saying we should fear our friends, but we fear strangers way out of proportion to the likelihood that strangers will hurt us. In other words, let me give a few examples. In the U.S., the proportion of murder victims who knew their assailants – to victims who were killed by strangers is about 3 to 1, okay?
Wow.
So you're about 3 times more likely to die if you get murdered, very rare event, but if you get murdered, it's probably going to be by somebody you know. Women who are raped or victims of aggravated assault, about 65 or 61% respectively, likely to have known their attacker. Here's one.
So more likely than not to have known their attacker.
Much more likely than not. Here's a big one. Child abduction, right? Whenever a stranger snatches a child, it's this huge, horrible event.
Amber alert.
You know, Amber alert. Yeah, sure. It's the shark attack of the human world. You know, it's
very...
Now, check this out. In one recent year for which a study was done, in nearly 300,000, quote, abductions or instances in which a child was taken, nearly 300,000, 115 of them, 115, triple digits only, were actual kidnappings by a stranger. The rest were family, friend, estranged family member, and so on. So these events are very rare. And look, if you want to get real macro and get financial on us, the biggest financial fraud in history was perpetrated by a guy named Bernie Madoff who mostly took advantage of friends.
People he knew.
Allegedly.
Right, exactly. Right,
allegedly,
right.
Thank you.
Well, let's get back to the original example. Is that to say, based on everything that you've told us, that white guys dressed in Santa suits upset at their ex-wives and sad guys in resort towns who are angry at the rich and have access to bombs needn't worry because they're never going to be as scary as Muslim terrorists?
I guess if you want to be as cynical as you might often be, John Hockenberry, you might say yeah, because you know, if you're the low risk looking type of guy who wants to do something bad, you'll probably be able to fly under the radar a long time. Absolutely.
I wouldn't say you're low risk, but Stephen Dubner is co-author of the Freakonomics book and blog. He's going to stay with us, and we'll talk more Freakonomics in a musical vein when we get back right after headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thank you, John. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. French President Nicolas Sarkozy says that Israel and Palestine are accepting a ceasefire. It was proposed by France and Egypt. Illinois Senate appointee Roland Burris gained support from an unexpected ally yesterday. California Senator Dianne Feinstein said that the Senate should seat him. She says that Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich has the right to make the appointment, even if he's tainted by corruption charges. Burris will be meeting with Democratic leaders this morning. It's just an hour to go before the open on Wall Street, and right now the Dow's pointing downward. Investors received a new economic indicator yesterday. The average rent for all U.S. apartments fell in the fourth quarter for the first time in 5 years. Analysts say that landlords are lowering rents to keep vacancies down. And that's a look at some of the stories making headlines for you this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. At 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org, we are looking legitimately for a playlist to pull us out of this economic nightmare that we're in. And we're not just looking for your favorite songs. We want songs that are actually going to work, okay? Why? Well, here we go. Back in 1929, if you were sitting at a windowsill getting ready to jump out the window because you'd lost everything in the stock market crash, you might have heard this catchy little tune.
No one to talk with, all by myself. No one to walk with, but I'm happy on the shelf.
You hear that steady beat? Ain't misbehaving? Jump! That's my advice for you. Because of the research of Phil Maimon, who's here in the studio with us, he's a professor of finance and risk engineering at the Polytechnic Institute of New York, in New York University. Phil Maimon, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Let me encapsulate your research, and that is you have tracked the Billboard Top 100 and have determined that there are characteristics of music, including rhythmic characteristics, that are strongly associated with dark economic times ahead. And Ain't Misbehavin' was really popular in 1929. Lay out your thesis for me.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it. The steadiness versus or the turbulence of the music, the average of the so the, what I call the beat variance. It's how if it's a steady beat, if it's the same beat, no matter whether it's fast or slow, that's a low beat variance song. And if it starts off slow, becomes fast, and comes back down, that's a high beat variance, and that's a turbulent song. So
tempo changes,
right.
Fast speed, slow speed. Then,
right.
Now, so be careful. I want you to talk carefully because Stephen Dubner is still here, and we got Dora, you know, who's like big on music. So we got a lot of skeptics in the studio here. So
excellent.
Keep going.
So that's a measure of kind of the complexity of the song. You could think of it as the mood of the song. Is it the kind of song that you can kind of just, you know, snap your fingers to and not really think about too much, or is it more complex and it has all these beat changes and stuff?
All right. So complex seems to be good. What's an example of that?
Georgia on My Mind by Ray Charles.
Just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Georgia! Absolute classic.
So songs like those, so the first question you can ask is, let's take the beat variance of every song that's in the top 100 at the end of each year. Take
right.
the average.
Okay.
And let's just see how that compares to the variance of the market, the volatility of the market. Now, it's not exactly dark economic times versus good economic times. It's not like a hemline thing where we're looking at the return of the market. I wanted to look at the mood of the market. And I think the mood of the market, similarly as with songs, is best measured by volatility. So if you think of like if the first 11 months of the year are down years, down months, you know, and then the 12th month is up, you would call that a bull year because it ended up.
Right.
But you really didn't experience that 11 months of the year being up. It felt like a bear market.
And so Georgia on My Mind pretty much predicts that 1960 was a stable economic year as it was.
Right. And it turns out it had very low market volatility. So the relationship is surprising, at least in the first sense, that the more turbulent the songs, the steadier the music.
All right. So 2 years before the stock market crash of 1987, this little tune came out. Now explain this to me.
So this is A-ha's Take on Me. It's a very low. It's one of the 65, I think, lowest beat variance songs of all time. Surprisingly, most of those songs, the steadiest songs, were right around the 80s, right both before and after the crash, which was obviously the highest market volatility time of all time, except for this last year.
So you're saying dance music is bad?
I
don't know if we're buying that.
I mean, what if you're long volatility? Then it's very good.
Right.
Hey,
right,
Phil, persuade us that. So you're arguing some interesting correlation. So, tell me in what ways this even might be causal.
Right.
And if it is causal, how might it be significant then?
I don't know the causation yet. This is a first step. There's been no research looking at automatically determined characteristics of music and comparing it to financial markets ever before. So this is kind of a first step.
But the correlation is strong?
The correlation is pretty strong.
But what is the correlation? So are you saying every year lots of music is made? So are you saying that people respond to music differently based on how the market is doing or how they're feeling about how the market is doing? Or is it the music is a result of the anxiety that's produced because of the market?
So those two things is what I thought would happen. So I thought people would be living in a mood of the market where it's volatile and, I better get some steady music so I don't you know, to calm myself down in a sense.
Which may be why this tune is the current number one Billboard Top 100 hit. We got economic bad times. We got low beat variability there, and yeah. Beyonce's big hit.
Yeah.
So when the VIX is high, when volatility is high, you're saying that people who are actively engaged in the market seek out and perhaps make more popular music with low beat variants.
That's the first surprising result that seems to happen. And yes, that's the first thing. The second thing is the causation. Which way does it go? That's the first question. So I would have expected,
right,
the market causes
the
music.
And it seems,
if anything, based on, you know, correlations, it goes the other way. That the music, the turbulence of the music tends to predict the steadiness of the market in the future. So, in fact, you can create a profitable trading strategy, trading volatility for the past 50 years, just looking at the average beat variance of songs as released by Billboard at the end of December each year.
Well, Phil Maiman, I actually got on a GarageBand, I got on GarageBand last night and tried to come up with a song that would actually tip us into an even further recession. So listen to this track and see if it satisfies your criteria. I mean, first of all, it's dreadful. Absolute no beat variance at all.
Okay.
Are you feeling like bonds, you know, going down in value?
That's the interesting thing is I don't know how easy it is to feel it. These numbers come obviously from an automatic analysis of the song from a website called EchoNest, which just recently launched. So I don't know. The next thing I want to look at
causal.
Is to see.
It's not. I mean, the big question is.
I'd like to see: do traders trade differently when they listen to different music? That would be an interesting thing, right?
Well, how would traders listen to respond to this music then?
You don't want to
Ornette Coleman.
Yeah, you don't want to buy or sell too much because who knows what's going on. You just kind of want to steady, relax a little bit with your portfolio.
Are you convinced there's a real causal relationship here? And if so, do we need to care about it? Because I'll give a for instance. I got an email the other day that said that Detroit Lions were 0-16 last year. And if you look at the recent history, everybody involved with the team, their name starts with an M. There was Matt Millen, Martin Mayhew, Marty Morningway, Steve Mariucci, and Rob Marinelli. I don't think that's causal, but maybe this is.
Again, this is a first step. It's a new form of research to look at the link between popular culture and broad financial markets.
At the very least, it allows us to play a lot of interesting music. Phil Maiman, thanks so much for joining us. Assistant Professor of Finance and Risk Engineering at the Polytechnic Institute of New York University. And Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics blog and co-author of the Freakonomics book. And he's got a book coming out, right? How you doing?
Eventually.
Right? Eventually. It's high anxiety there. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. For more than 25 years, the Tamil rebels have been fighting for independence from the government of Sri Lanka. Today, the Sri Lankan army is continuing a major military assault to force the rebels to give up much of their territory. We spoke earlier with Roland Burke, who was covering this story from Colombo, Sri Lanka, for our partners, the BBC World Service. And I asked Roland to describe the significance of the fighting today.
Well, what's been happening is that since a ceasefire broke down on the ground in 2006, since it failed, the government has really been going all out to try to defeat the Tamil Tigers, to crush them on the battlefield, and to end their fight for a separate state for the ethnic Tamil minority here in Sri Lanka. First, they evicted the Tigers from the east, and now they are pushing into territory that the Tigers control in the north. In the last few days, they've captured a place called Kilinochi. Now, Kilinochi is a place that the Tigers used really as their de facto capital, a place from where they administered territory under their control. And they had things like their own law courts, administrative offices, kind of health services, even their own bank. So the fact that that's now in government hands is a setback to their project to create a separate state.
So essentially, their parallel government has been attacked, and that would certainly indicate that the Sri Lankan government is making inroads against the rebels.
Yes, they certainly are. They've taken a very large amount of territory from the Tigers, and the rebels, as well as civilians who are with them, some estimates say around 250,000. The government would dispute that. And I pushed into an area of jungle in the northeast of Sri Lanka that's about the size of the city of LA, and that's really being attacked from a number of sides at the moment, and the government says it's sure that in the coming weeks it's going to capture that area from the Tamil Tigers too, completely clearing the rebels from the island in terms of them controlling territory.
Is it tough to assess, though, because the government is providing all of this information and there hasn't been a whole lot of independent verification of exactly how this battle is going and what areas have been claimed by the government and which ones the rebels have managed to maintain?
Yes, it's true that the government does control access by journalists into the areas where the fighting is taking place very closely, only offering really very rare guided tours up there. But certainly they have captured Kilinochchi, this major town, this important symbolic target of their offensive. And certainly the Tigers are on the back foot, and in terms of territory, they've lost a very large amount of territory. I think that what's of concern to diplomats here is that whether this a military victory on the ground can be translated into a political settlement, whether the government will perhaps win the war but lose the peace. And I think that's the concern here, that perhaps this war could be won in the sense that the government could take all the land from the Tigers, but that it could just turn into a guerrilla war and there could be more bombings in places like Colombo.
Roland, is there any particular reason why the government has moved so aggressively right now?
Well, they really got an electoral mandate to do that. People here really widely believe in the Sinhalese majority community that the only way to deal with the Tigers is to crush them by force.
That was BBC correspondent Roland Burke in an interview that we did earlier this morning with him about Sri Lanka's current situation with the Tamil rebels. He was reporting from Colombo, Sri Lanka.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, January 7th, and Femi Oke has a few headlines for us this morning.
Hello there. The time is 30 minutes to the top of the hour. French President Nicolas Sarkozy says that Israel and the Palestinian Authority have accepted an Egyptian-French peace plan for Gaza. Sarkozy says that he strongly welcomes their acceptance. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says that this year's military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan will cost almost $140 billion. That means that the Pentagon needs an additional $70 billion to continue at the current pace. He says this is only his personal assessment and doesn't reflect either the outgoing or incoming administrations. Meanwhile, the US military says that coalition forces have killed 32 insurgents in eastern Afghanistan. They were attacked by militants during a strike on a roadside bomb-making cell. They also destroyed weapons and explosive supplies found there. It's chilly for tens of thousands of Europeans today. They're without heat because of a lack of gas supplies. Europe usually receives it through Ukraine pipelines, but Russia cut off Ukraine last week over a dispute about its unpaid gas bill. Europe diversified its gas supply after a similar dispute 3 years ago. And finally, fans are saying goodbye to Ron Ashton. He was the guitarist with the punk band The Stooges. Ashton played with the Stooges on their early albums. Rolling Stone magazine named him the 29th most influential guitar player of all time. And Ashton died in his Michigan home yesterday. He was age 60. Well,
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
So we are, among the other things we're doing on this program, is making a mixtape to get the country out of its bad financial mood. We want you to set the mood for us. What's a song that you think can perk up the economy?
Hi, my name is Tom Kligerman. I'm calling from my car on the way to work, which I shouldn't be doing. I'm actually parked right now, but I would say to boost the economy, anything by Chuck Berry.
Oh, well, I feel so good today. We just touched ground on an international runway.
Complete classic, but steady rhythm. I don't know, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
That would certainly be some upbeat music. And now on to a story that, well, it could be considered upbeat for some and perhaps not for others, but not necessarily for Roland Burris, the man who has been nominated by Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich to take over Barack Obama's Senate seat. Well, that story yesterday took a curious turn in Washington, D.C.
I presented my credentials to the Secretary of the Senate and advised that my credentials were not in order and I would not be accepted, nor would I be seated, nor would I be permitted on the floor.
That was Roland Burris. It was not unexpected that the Senate would not swear him in yesterday, but how the Senate blocked him was interesting, claiming Burris did not have the relevant approval and paperwork from Illinois state officials. To parse through some of this, we're joined by Abner Mikva. He is a former Illinois congressman and retired federal judge and currently a law professor at the University of Chicago, a very wise man. Good morning, Judge Mikva, and welcome.
Good morning.
So a bit of dramatics there yesterday in the Senate, where you have the Senate using state law against Roland Burris. So essentially suggesting that the Secretary of State has the power to ignore an order by the governor?
Well, he doesn't have the power, and ultimately I'm sure that a judge will somewhere, probably the Supreme Court of Illinois, will tell him he must sign that certificate. But in the meantime, I think the Senate secretary is technically correct. It's as if Roland Burris came in without his certificate at all, because the law requires that it be signed by both the governor and the Secretary of State. Now, it's a technicality, but it's one that the Senate is probably on better ground on than they are on the other reasons for refusing to seat him.
So then this gets resolved then by a lawsuit that's taking place in Illinois.
That's correct.
And the question there is?
But whether the Secretary of State can refuse to sign that certificate. And I see no reason why he can refuse to sign it. He hasn't offered any, and I can't think of any. So my guess is that the Supreme Court will tell Secretary of State White that he must sign the certificate, and he will sign it. And at that point, Roland will present the certificate to the Secretary of the Senate again, and then that's when the road gets very, very hard, because...
For the Senate,
because there is no... I don't know of any legal reason that they can refuse to seat him.
They have claimed that, or at least previously in the last couple of weeks, we've certainly heard some Senate leaders saying that they would not seat him, and that has been the question, whether or not they would have the power to block that appointment by the governor.
Well, I came into the House of Representatives, and we're governed by the same constitutional provision, both the House and the Senate. I came into the U.S. House of Representatives in 1969, and one of my first votes was whether or not to seat a congressman by the name of Adam Clayton Powell. The House refused to seat him. I'm proud to say that I voted the other way. I voted that he should be seated. But in any event, the House refused to seat him. And
because there were some allegations of corruption against him.
Of corruption, right, involving Congressman Powell. And he took his appeal all the way to the United States Supreme Court, and they said that, no, the House did not have the authority to decide who to seat or not, as long as he met the constitutional qualifications. That is, he was the right age, and he was a citizen of the state that he was elected from, and so on.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, it's your estimation, then, that once this issue about Illinois state law is resolved, that the U.S. Senate probably doesn't have much recourse to keep Roland Burris out. Now, you've known Roland Burris for a long time. The person that you see waging this battle, is this the man you know, and what do you think is driving him?
Well, I think what's driving him is that he's 71 years old, and he decides this is his last chance to at the brass ring, and so he's clutching onto it for with all the might he has. It's not the Roland Burris I've known. He was a much shyer person when he was active in politics in Illinois, but I think he sees this as his last claim to glory, and he's going to take advantage of it. But I think that ultimately the question is when, but I think that ultimately the Senate is going to have to seat him, whether they like to or not, because the appointment, once it's properly certified, was made by a governor who still has the legal authority to make the appointment.
Judge Mikva, this is Stephen Dubner. I've got a yes. question for you. You know a little something about political distractions. You've been around a few of them. This is a big one, in part because our president-to-be is affiliated with this situation, obviously. Who will this distraction benefit and or harm if it blows up even bigger?
Well, I think it's bothering the president-elect from trying to push forward on his program. He's got a very full agenda, and there's a time ticking on it, and he's a time ticker on it, and he would like to have people concentrate on passing that economic package. And this argument over whether or not Senator Roland Burris is a senator or isn't is distracting from the impetus that President-elect Obama would like to see put on his economic package. So it distracts from him, and it hurts him. Now, how big a hurt it is, I don't think it's going to continue to distract, if for no other reason than simply that the economic problems are so serious and so so difficult that everyone is going to recognize that should take priority over whether or not Roland Burris is or is not a senator.
Abner Mikva, thank you so much. You're saying ultimately you think they're going to have no choice in the U.S. Senate but to seat Roland Burris. Thank you for joining us.
You bet.
That was Judge Abner Mikva, former Illinois congressman, a retired federal judge, and now a law professor at the University of Chicago.
As many have said, the time is on the side of Roland Burris there in the Senate and Rod Blagojevich in his battles with the federal prosecutor. So we're changing the subject right now based on some very intriguing but soft science. We're making a mixtape to get the country out of its bad financial mood. It seems that certain kinds of music predict or are possibly correlated with bad economic times. Set the mood for us. What's a song you think can perk up the economy? It's from Gerald, who sent an email. Ho, ho, hi, ho, it's off to work we go, if there is any work. Gaylord in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, emailed us his pick, this Bob Marley song.
Don't worry about a thing.
So what would Professor Mywin say about reggae? No steadier beat than the Marley Reggae Shuffle. Help make an economic stimulus music playlist by calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We're always on. If you missed anything, including some of that great music, take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Current and former leaders of the free world gather for a historic lunch at the White House today. What could help to bring world peace?
I would definitely go with a warm dessert on a day like today. Maybe going with a warm creme brulee or souffle.
Hey, a former White House pastry chef says maybe we'll just have to settle for a great warm dessert. Presidents and their menus. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, January 7th, and boy, that sounds good. That is Chef Roland Mesnier. He was the chief chef a pastry chef at the White House for 26 years, and he served all of the presidents. And he's going to have some tips for what that lunch might look like today.
Yes,
good morning.
Wouldn't you love to have some of those desserts?
Mm. Absolutely. Good morning, everyone. We're also going to talk about warnings from President-elect Obama about a $1 trillion deficit. And we have the story about a Utah college student who's taking on big oil and gas. Those stories are coming up first. These headlines.
It's not exactly a French dessert, but the French are hastening world peace on a possible diplomatic breakthrough in the Gaza crisis. Different parties are saying different things. We'll be clear about what we know at this moment. French President Nicolas Sarkozy says that Israel and the Palestinian Authority have accepted a ceasefire plan, the one France and Egypt have developed. Israel isn't going that far yet. It says it merely welcomes the plan and would accept only under certain conditions involving Hamas. That's what we can confirm right now. Now, it's not a full-scale ceasefire, but Israel did pause its attacks briefly today. Military spokesman Major Abitai Leibovich explains.
There will be a ceasefire for a couple of hours in which the residents will be able to go outside freely and get some equipment, get medical attention, get supplies, basically whatever they need.
We'll see how these apparent ceasefire movements affects all of that. Here's Hamas spokesman Ghazi Hamad on the Israeli pause.
You can stop their military aggression against Gaza, and people can stop also the firing missiles from Gaza here. But this needs more and more procedures and more steps in order to put guarantees for the security and the truce in Gaza Strip.
More on the developments in Gaza live this hour.
Illinois Senate appointee Roland Burris is scheduled to meet with top Senate Democrat Harry Reid today. And as you may have heard, he was basically not allowed to be sworn in yesterday, as other senators were being sworn in. Reid, though, has hinted at the possibility of a deal that could get Burris, who was appointed by the embattled Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. Well, Reid says Burris may actually get that seat in the end. The winter cold is in full force, so news this morning of an energy crisis is especially disturbing for those who are living in countries where natural gas has been cut off. A lot of European gas comes from Russia through Ukraine. Russia and Ukraine have been in an energy fight for a while, and they're blaming each other for the European shutdown.
So the Dow gained nearly 0.75 percentage point yesterday. The S&P begins trading in about a half hour at 9:34. Apparently, music can potentially soothe the savage market. We're putting together a playlist, and we want to hear your suggestion at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Certain kinds of music predict economic turmoil.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. As President-elect Barack Obama makes the rounds in Washington, D.C. and prepares to present a stimulus package to the country, he's warning the nation that the economic situation is so perilous that remedies might send the deficit to $1 trillion.
We're going to be investing an extraordinary amount of money to jumpstart our economy, save or create 3 million new jobs, mostly in the private sector, and lay a solid foundation for future growth.
Today, the Congressional Budget Office is set to release its latest budget estimates. And joining us on the line for more is New York Times reporter Jeff Zeleny.
Good morning.
So is this a question of managing expectations in the face of a very dire situation?
Well, that's part of it, but it's also a case of really just laying it out there and saying it like it is. And you saw President-elect Obama yesterday. I'm trying to get in front of what people already know is the bad news. But he's doing it, you know, while he's still not quite the president. So he can say this, but he doesn't, he's able to point out that this is a problem that he's inheriting. But using the word really, he said again and again, we're going to have $1 trillion deficits for years to come. It was a stark reminder of the problems that are going to follow him through his first term in office.
And this comes on the heels of the report from the minutes from the Federal Reserve meeting last week that essentially said that the economy is going to deteriorate further this year and that unemployment will rise into 2010.
Exactly. And some of those numbers will be coming out later this week. And really, he is setting the stage for what he knows will be a tough year. But he is saying that, we need to spend more money before we can begin tightening the controls on budget spending. So he is really using this yesterday as a way to sell his economic stimulus plan. So he is sort of fighting a two-front war here. He is trying to urge Congress to spend some $775 billion, almost $800 billion. And then at the same time, he's saying after the economy hopefully begins to rebound, we're going to have to rein in spending. So this is something that we are going to see as really the soundtrack to his first term in office. And there's nothing he can do about it at this point. So he's just saying it like it is in the words of One Aid. He's getting the bad news out there because that's the news that there is.
And as you report in your article today, that really is this balancing act of making it clear to lawmakers and to the markets and to Americans that he's aware of the dangers of big deficits.
There's no question, especially in the time of almost a frozen, credit markets. And yesterday he did not get really into the specifics of how big of a problem this is, how major of a problem this growing debt is. He just sort of laid it out there. But we're going to hear more from him tomorrow in a speech, really his first major address as president-elect of the new year. He'll be talking about the economy. So you will hear and see him talk about the economy virtually every day between now and January 20th when he's sworn into office, and certainly once he becomes president.
And let's quickly just talk about, lastly, the Congressional Budget Office releasing budget numbers. I mean, you're reporting today that the beginning of the fiscal year, the 2009 fiscal year, began on October 1st, and that the government spent $408 billion more than it brought in?
Exactly, and those are some of the numbers here that are the reality. I mean, remember all the bailouts, remember all the TARP spending, et cetera, all the money that was being spent during the remaining months of the fall. So that is some of the reality that is forming the backdrop here for what President-elect Barack Obama is talking about. So he stopped short of saying it was a problem that he inherited, but certainly his advisors are hoping that that is a point that the American voters will see, especially when all the presidents are meeting today for lunch. But interestingly, he is having a 30-minute special meeting with President Bush ahead of the other luncheon with the president, so perhaps they will have some time to talk about this.
A long, hard road. Thank you very much, Jeff Zeleny.
Thank you.
Jeff Zeleny is a reporter for The New York Times, and he was coming to us from Washington.
As we've heard, every day more details on the stimulus package that President-elect Barack Obama wants Congress to work on and possibly even have on his desk the day he is inaugurated on January 20th. And we've learned already this week that 40% of it may include tax cuts. To try to determine which part of the stimulus package is actually more associated with stimulus and less associated with the kinds of sort of financial bailouts that we've seen during the last days of the Bush administration, let's talk to Mark Zandi, chief economist at moodyseconomy.com. Mark joins us on the phone. Thanks for being part of the program, Mark.
Thank you.
Let me ask you the first question about the tax cuts. It seems to me that the Bush administration learned a bit of a lesson in their much smaller stimulus package of 2008 when they discovered that a lot of the money in that stimulus package, which was direct checks to American consumers, actually went into savings and wasn't necessarily spent. In the tax cuts that are envisioned, $300 billion of them or more, in this stimulus package as you see so far, in this environment, is that more likely to be saved or actually spent?
I think a fair share will be spent. I think a half to two-thirds will ultimately be spent. But you do make a good point, and that's why a stimulus package needs to be heavy on government spending, that the tax cuts will only get you so far. They're useful because you can get them into the economy quickly, but
We also need government spending because that packs a much larger economic punch.
So the large punch comes from the government spending, but the quick sort of slap comes from the actual tax cuts. You're going to be testifying on Capitol Hill today. What's your advice?
Well, I think we do need a stimulus package. It needs to be large. The number that is being used is $775 billion. That's about 5% of the nation's GDP. And I think that's an appropriate number, given the severity of the situation that we're in. And I do think a combination of tax cuts to get some money into the economy quickly and increased spending, which will be pack a big economic punch later this year and into 2010, is needed. So we need both those things, and it needs to be – all this, of course, needs to be done very quickly because the economy is in very significant is having very significant problems.
Well, and speed is part of the problem here in the sense that there's likely to be an argument in Congress about who the tax cuts are targeted to. President-elect Barack Obama has called for so-called middle-class tax cuts, but that embodies a lot of people in the American economy. What's your recommendation for who and what income levels these tax cuts should be targeted towards?
You know, I think the tax cuts should be broad-based. That'll make it easier to get through Congress and get it out into the economy quickly. And I think there's some evidence that this economic downturn is not discriminating. It's hitting everybody, lower-income households, middle-income households, and even higher-income households. And they do a lot of spending, and they're pulling back. So I think it makes sense to have these tax cuts across the board. It'll be simple. We'll get it done fast, and it'll be very helpful to the economy.
Now, at every one of these news conferences, President-elect Barack Obama has been saying we can't worry about the deficit now, but he certainly mentioned the trillion-dollar number yesterday. We've been asking all of the economists who come on the show this same question, and that is, what is the clock that is ticking on when the deficit begins to have an impact on the economy in terms of things like inflation, our ability to actually finance our federal cash flow, those kinds of things?
Well, it's not a problem this year. The fact is that no one else is borrowing. Businesses aren't borrowing. Consumers aren't able to borrow. So the government really is the only borrower of any significant consequence. So there's a window for the Treasury to borrow money at a low interest rate. But that doesn't mean there aren't limits, and it doesn't mean that we aren't going to have significant budgetary problems. But those aren't reasons that for not doing a big stimulus package today. But I do think we need to realize that our next biggest problem a year, two, three down the road is going to be how are we going to address these the long-term budget consequences of what we're going through.
Well, I hope you're, sober in your testimony on, not literally sober, but, because you're really sketching out a situation over the next 4 years where Barack Obama is going to be dealing with historic unemployment in the first couple of years and then potentially historic inflationary consequences of the deficit in the last 2 years of his administration. Some rough waters ahead. Mark Zandi, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Mark Zandi is chief economist at Moody'sEconomy.com. He's going to be testifying on Capitol Hill today, and he's the author of Financial Shock, a 360 look at the subprime mortgage implosion and how to avoid the next financial crisis.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's a little early to be thinking about lunchtime, but we're thinking about lunchtime because there are lots of special lunches that take place at the White House, but none quite like the one that is happening today. President Bush will host President-elect Obama and all three living former presidents for lunch. So what's going to be on the menu? For an idea of what each man likes, we've invited Master Chef Roland Mesnier, who for more than two decades was the White House executive pastry chef. And he served each president, excluding, of course, the future president. And those experiences ended up in his book, All the President's Pastry, 25 Years in the White House, a Memoir. Good morning and welcome, Chef.
Thank you. Thank you.
And so if you had to guess, if you, knowing these men as you do, if you had to guess, what do you think they're having for dessert today?
Ah, that's a good question. Since I've left now the White House, I do not know too much how they operate these days. But if it was me, let's say, having such a bad weather here, it's raining a lot, and the weather is kind of on the dark side and cool and wet, I would definitely go with a warm dessert on a day like today. Possibly a very nice warm cobbler, something of that nature, or even maybe going with a warm creme brulee or souffle, something that would make them feel really good, especially having all these presidents around the table. There's about to be a little bit of an uncomfortable moment, probably, and you wanted to make everybody feel good, and you would like to have a dessert that is very homey.
Mm-hmm.
Even a nice baked apple on a day like today would be fantastic.
Well, they all sound lovely, but you actually cooked for President Carter. You actually prepared pastries for President Bush,
yes.
Both President Bushes, and President Clinton. Okay, so let us in on some secrets. Who's got the biggest sweet tooth?
Well, from all these four presidents, I would say they all did, maybe for the exception of President Carter, that they like to stay away from dessert unless they had guests. But all these three last ones really have enjoyed dessert. I mean, you know, you have to realize most of the presidents, when they come to the White House, they all make statements that they're not big on sweet. And that may be true for the case of having a pastry chef that maybe is not too creative or doesn't renew his menu too often. But when I was at the White House, he was not, well, tonight we're going to have our preferred dessert, which is so-and-so, such and such. He would be like, well, what are we getting tonight? They will be excited on dessert time and what will be coming to the table because they knew that it will always be something different and something that they never had before.
So what was President George W. Bush's favorite?
He likes more like the type of creme brulee and warm dessert, not so much big on cakes and things of this nature, but more like home-type dessert, you know.
And how about President Clinton?
Well, President Clinton had allergy. He was allergic to chocolate,
uh-huh.
Allergic to dairy product, and allergic to flour.
Oh, my gosh, that's crazy for a pastry chef.
And exactly. And that didn't make my life very easy at the beginning, but then I saw it more like as a challenge, a great challenge for me to go into something that I'd never really gone into before.
Like Jell-O?
No. That's I would stay away from Jell-O. But I would make sure that I would put something on the table that everybody could eat and everybody would enjoy. So I made a lot of research on how I could create new recipe. And actually, it was fairly easy to come up with things if you put your mind into it. And President Clinton did love his dessert. He had dessert every single meal. But I came up with a lot of new recipe that I hold in my book.
Like, give us an example.
Well, to give you an example, one year I created a very great strawberry cake which is listed in my book, Dessert University, as a low-calorie strawberry cake.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a lot of strawberry cooked in different ways, so that the water is extracted from the strawberries. So you have a whole fruit that is so concentrated in flavor, and this is put in the middle of a yellow cake that has no flour in it. Instead of flour, I'm using spelt. And, of course, you can use any dairy or any cream or any type. So sometimes,
Chef, before we go, just quickly, since President Carter, Rosalynn Carter, his wife, actually hired you, what was his favorite?
Well, he liked cakes very much. The Carter liked cakes, especially when the president was present, was at the meal. He liked chocolate cake. He was very partial to that. But Mrs. Carter liked more the type of fruit dessert, you know, like a raspberry Napoleon or a lot of apple dessert were served then, you know, with puff pastries.
And so you would expect today they're probably going to have some very interesting desserts on that table. Chef Roland Mesnier, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
It all sounds so good. Chef Roland Mesnier, a master pastry chef and former executive pastry chef for the White House, where he worked for more than two decades. And he's also the author of 25 Years in the White House in Memoir. And now Femi Okeh's got a few headlines for us.
And the time is 27 minutes past the hour. Now, we're getting some different reports in about the situation in Gaza. French President Nicolas Sarkozy says that Israel and the Palestinian Authority have accepted a proposed peace plan, but Israel hasn't confirmed this yet. Congressional estimators are projecting a budget deficit of $1.2 trillion for this budget year. The Congressional Budget Office also sees a $703 billion deficit for 2010, and the dismal figures come a day after President-elect Barack Obama warned of trillion-dollar deficits for years to come. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says that Congress can't wait to approve a plan to jumpstart the economy.
We need action, and we need action now.
And the information that's just been released from the Congressional Budget Office does not include the figures for the huge economic stimulus bill that the president-elect is expected to propose very soon. Tens of thousands of Europeans are without heat today. That's because the continent has been cut off from natural gas. It usually flows through via Ukraine, but Russia cut off Ukraine last week after a dispute about its unpaid gas bill. Illinois Senate appointee Roland Burris is meeting with Democratic leaders today to make his case for a place in the Senate. California Senator Dianne Feinstein got behind him yesterday. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. There's a professor at New York University who says there's a connection between how the market is doing and what kind of music we're listening to. What do you think about that? Is there certain music you listen to when economic times are good? And are there sometimes songs you listen to when economic times are bad?
The song that I choose is Ain't No Stopping Us Now by McFadden and Whitehead.
There's been so many things that's held us down. But now it looks like things are finally coming around.
That would be a song I think you listen to perk yourself up when times are bad. So how do you listen to music when the economic tide is turning up and down? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
We are putting together a playlist. And joining us now is Tim DeChristopher, who's a senior at the University of Utah. Tim, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
You're in Salt Lake City, and I have to ask you, how many acres of Bureau of Land Management land do you, at least on paper, own the drilling and mining rights for?
Well, I don't quite own it yet, but in the auction, I won the rights to about 22,500 acres.
So you're a landowner, but as you say, it's not completely clear yet, because when the U.S. Bureau of Land Management auctioned off gas and oil leases in Utah last month, there were activists outside protesting, but DeChristopher actually bid on some of those leases and won a $1.7 million parcel of land. And you don't have the money to pay for this, right?
No, and the intent wasn't really to make a purchase. It was more of an act of civil disobedience to stop the auction.
The idea was to have disruptive people in the auction who would make the price sort of moot, and maybe the auction would be canceled, but at the very least, you bid up the price for people who were actually bidding on those leases, correct?
Right. That's what I started with before I actually won any parcels. I just drove up the prices for a while.
Now, this is a felony, Tim.
Yeah, no charges have been pressed yet, so it's still unclear.
Well, what was the...
But I knew that there would be consequences like that when I was going into it. I realized that before I took any action.
Now, what made you decide to do this particular style of civil disobedience versus just a traditional form of protest?
Well, I've done all the traditional forms that are supposed to be accesses to power or pathways to change. I've protested, held signs, marched. I've written letters, signed petitions, spoke to my congressman. I've directly volunteered in national parks and things like that. And all that has seemed a little ineffective and hasn't put us on a path towards a livable future. So I've seen the need for a while now for more serious action by the environmental movement.
All right, well, so 2 points here. If everybody had done that, or if 50 people had done that at the auction, it could have seriously disrupted and possibly even ended the lease auction, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
But an environmentalist, and certainly someone noted for being opposed to full-fledged drilling in federal lands, is Barack Obama and the transition team, including some members of Congress, and John Podesta, the head of the transition team, has said that the lease sale should be halted or altered to accommodate environmental concerns. Do you think they would support the steps you took?
I don't know if they would directly support my steps, but I had that in mind while I was taking action, and that's what gave me the hope that maybe this would actually have the effect of protecting some of that land and keeping some of that oil in the ground, was that if I could put it off for long enough that they could come into office and reconsider this auction and give it the due process that it's lacked up to this point, that maybe it could really have a lasting effect.
Take me into the auction. I mean, you're sitting there. There's probably some, somebody from Exxon across the aisle from you, or I don't know what. You actually bid $1.7 million for something. Explain what you feel like in your stomach when you're doing that.
Well, it was a major struggle that I was going through right beforehand, because I didn't go in there with the intent of doing this, and it wasn't especially planned out. I went there with the intent of being a little more disruptive than the protesters who are holding signs outside. And so I just walked into the building and kind of expected to get thrown out by security. But then once I walked in, they said, "Hi, are you here to be a bidder?" And I said, "Well, yes, I am." And so I signed up as a bidder and got inside the auction room and saw that some kind of speech or disruption or anything like that certainly wasn't going to have any effect. But I saw pretty quickly that I could have a major effect by bidding, by driving up the prices for others and taking some of the parcels off the table so that they didn't get developed.
How did you bid? Did you use a sign? Did you hold up a card? How did it work?
Yeah, they just had a little bid card. I was number 70, and it was basically just a laminated piece of paper with a big number 70 on it.
Who were you bidding against? Who were you bidding against, and who did you beat?
I don't know exactly who all the oil companies were. I've heard since then that there was Flying J was one of them, Halliburton was one of them. There were a few other companies.
Now, they have filed objections that the price that you drove up is, a liability and something that they shouldn't have to pay for. What do you think about that?
Well, I think there's a lot of external costs in developing oil that they don't have to pay, that all the rest of us pay in our tax dollars. The cost of the loss of recreation, the health care cost that comes from the pollution, and the cost of mitigating global warming. And so I think what I did was drive up their prices a little closer to the actual cost of developing oil. And the thing is, they apparently found that acceptable, that apparently what they were paying was so far below the real value for those leases
decent,
that they were still willing to,
decent,
to pay the inflated prices that I drove up.
All right, Tim, before we go, when you finally told them, hey, I'm a fraud, I have no intention of paying for these, what was their reaction?
Well, it was I was already in custody at that point of the BLM law enforcement officials, and so it was them that I had that conversation with. And they were very friendly and respectful, and we had a very open conversation about exactly why I did it and what my motivations were and why I thought that this was a fraudulent auction and why I thought it was a threat to my future.
All right. Well, we will see what happens in your future. At the very least, you're facing, at least on paper, felony charges. Tim DeChristopher, senior at University of Utah. He comes from Salt Lake City, where the takeaway is heard on the local public radio station. Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
But to live outside the law, you must be honest.
And now our outlaw with the headlines, Femi Okay.
Hello there, 21 minutes to the top of the hour. French President Nicolas Sarkozy says that Israel and the Palestinian Authority have agreed to the truce proposed by France and Egypt. But Israel says that while it welcomes the plan in principle, it will continue to consider it. There's been no response yet from the Palestinian Authority or Hamas. The plan calls for a stop to Israel's military campaign. The Israeli cabinet is, meanwhile, considering whether to press on with its military campaign or consider some form of ceasefire in the light of the international concern about the plight of civilians. A three-hour ceasefire to help civilians get supplies was enforced this morning on the Gaza Strip. And Congress is projecting a deficit of $1.2 trillion for the 2009 budget, and that number is unprecedented. And it comes a day after President-elect Barack Obama warned of trillion-dollar deficits for years to come. That's a look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. And we're going to turn back to that conversation about Roland Burris. He's the man who was appointed by Rod Blagojevich, the governor of Illinois, to the Senate seat that is being vacated or has been vacated by President-elect Barack Obama. Now, yesterday, Burris tried to be seated in the Senate, but he was turned away. We turn to Todd Zwillick of Capital News Connection right now to find out what is the next chapter in this ongoing saga. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning.
So they turned him away. They said that he did not have the correct paperwork from the state of Illinois, which would include a signature by the Secretary of State. Does that appear to be valid? And what happens next?
Well, whether or not it's valid is going to be an issue for the parliamentarians and possibly the lawyers to decide. If it ever gets to that, what happens today, Adora, is Burris is scheduled to meet with Harry Reid, the majority leader, the man who ultimately makes the decisions, and, of course, Dick Durbin, who is not only the assistant majority leader, but the senior senator from Illinois. So they're going to meet presumably to negotiate, and it's unclear what a negotiation between these three gentlemen would look like.
Yeah, yeah, Reid exactly. Said, like, what are the options? Harry Reid initially, a couple of weeks ago, said there was no way the Senate was ever going to seat anyone appointed by Rod Blagojevich, given the allegations of corruption against him right now, particularly trying to sell Barack Obama's Senate seat.
Right, and you're right. Reid has said he'll never be seated. So Reid could say, Mr. Burris, we all love you. You'll never be seated as long as Blagojevich is nominated. You know, he did say over the weekend that if the lieutenant governor nominates Roland Burris, if Blagojevich does step down or is impeached, and the lieutenant governor nominates Roland Burris, then that's fine. Trying to make the point that Burris isn't the issue, Blagojevich is the issue. So he could reiterate that point of view, encourage the governor to step down and you'll be fine.
But having said that, though, Todd, also over the weekend, Senator Reid indicated that perhaps there was some room for negotiations, and I think that was basically part of the quote.
Well, he did, you're right. And it's also, we should point out, Reid's options may be running thin here. Also remember that Dianne Feinstein of California, who's in charge of the Rules Committee, backed Burris's case yesterday, or seemed to, said that he seemed to be on solid legal footing. If a lot of Democrats start to trickle, you know, make comments publicly that Burris has the right to be seated, then Harry Reid starts to run out of options. You know, another way to negotiate is to say, we'll seat you, but you agree not to run in 2010. You know, Reid is allegedly concerned that Burris can't win statewide in Illinois, and he doesn't want to lose that seat. That's important to him to keep his numbers strong. So he could say, you can't run in 2010, or we'll seat you and stay a senator only for a year and then resign. You get privileges, you get, you know, all of the things that come with being an ex-senator, but then we can put our person in who we want to run statewide, who has a better chance of winning. It's all very complicated. It's just a wild speculation, Adora. It is unclear what a negotiation between them would really look like.
Todd, we appreciate your honesty telling us that you were just wildly speculating on what's going to happen on Capitol Hill today.
I wish I could be in there.
Todd Zwillick, Capitol News Connection. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. In just a moment, the very latest on the potential for a ceasefire in the Gaza crisis. We're going to be talking with Stephen Erlanger of The New York Times and Rob Watson, BBC defense correspondent from London. But first, we'll catch you up on all the other headlines from Femi Okeh.
Hello there. The time is 30 minutes to the top of the hour. People across Europe could find themselves a little colder this winter now that Russia gas supplies are cut off. The shutdown comes because of a dispute between Russia and Ukraine. Europe gets a quarter of its natural gas from Russia, and nearly all of that arrives through Ukraine. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says that the Afghanistan and Iraq wars will cost around about $136 billion. He's asking Congress for an additional $70 billion. The Pentagon plans to beef up the troop presence in Afghanistan. Five Blackwater security guards accused of killing civilians in a shooting in 2007 in Baghdad will be waiting until next year to go on trial. The judge set the trial date this week, and David Shetler, who's an attorney for a Blackwater defendant, Dustin Hurd, says the guards didn't do anything wrong.
They were defending themselves in a battlefield in a war zone, and we're confident that when we go to trial, we'll be able to prove that.
Now, a sixth Blackwater guard who's also pleaded guilty late last year to charges of voluntary manslaughter. He will be helping prosecutors with his when he testifies at the trial. The other guards say that they are not guilty. A major clash involving American troops in Afghanistan. Coalition forces came under heavy attack in the east. They beat back the militants, killing dozens of them. Let's look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. We're joined now by Steve Erlanger, The New York Times in Jerusalem, and Rob Watson, BBC defense correspondent in London. Steve Erlanger, we have some details that possibly a French and Egyptian-initiated ceasefire agreement may be on the table. According to French sources, including the French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, Israel has accepted this proposal. A government spokesman in Jerusalem, though, says Israel only welcomes it. What do you know at this point, and what is the state of hostilities at this hour?
Israel has not accepted it, and you know, French President Nicolas Sarkozy likes to create reality of his own kind. The French have been working with the Americans, the Turks, the Egyptians on bringing an end to the fighting. That is certainly true. And the Israelis have welcomed some of that discussion. And they say they will send a couple top aides to Prime Minister Olmert to Cairo to discuss it in the next couple of days. I suspect that may accelerate, but we're a long way from you know, an acceptable ceasefire. Israel has certain conditions, which they say right now mean an absolute end to offensive rocket fire, et cetera, coming out of Gaza, aimed at Israel, and a serious means to prevent the continued smuggling of rockets and arms into Gaza from Egypt. And short of those two conditions, I don't think there's going to be a very effective ceasefire.
And that falls short of the durability test that the Bush administration has asked for here. Quickly, is it in Israel's interest for Egypt's credibility and profile to be raised here, since they're the last ones who are able to actually mediate something? And is that possibly something that the French are trying to accomplish?
Well, I think Egypt is crucial to all this, simply because it's their border, and there's no one else on that border. And the hope is that the Egyptians will be willing to let the Americans and possibly Europeans help the Egyptians through advice and consultation through corps of engineers figure out ways to better seal the border to prevent tunnels. But, you know, this notion that somehow an international force is going to march in onto the Gaza, the Egyptian border, seems to me slightly far-fetched.
Rob Watson of the BBC in London, is it true that there's reality and then there's Nicolas Sarkozy's reality, as Steve Erlanger suggests?
I got to say I agree very much with Steve's take, and that is that, if you like, the French president, who is a self-declared sort of showman who has made a big splash since this crisis began, I think it's absolutely right in a sense by saying, look, everybody's agreed. It's like trying to create a different reality. And if you like, to put pressure on both sides, not just the Israelis, but the Palestinians too, to say, yes, we're ready to stop.
But Rob, what does he gain by doing that, and particularly announcing that there's some kind of agreement with the Palestinian Authority and the West Bank that doesn't include Hamas? How does that further the dialogue and move Israel and Hamas towards some kind of ceasefire?
Well, I guess it kind of depends on what happens next, doesn't it? I mean, if a ceasefire does follow fairly shortly, then you could say, well, sort of job done. And I suppose, you know, even if it doesn't, it sort of does put a kind of certain amount of pressure on both sides. I mean, if you have one of the negotiators saying, look, we're there or almost there, you know, those who are party to the negotiations do feel a certain amount of pressure. But look, I think this is a case of his rather flamboyant and unique style. I mean, of course, some people would say that he rather jumped the gun in the Russia-Georgia ceasefire earlier last year.
Is there any chance, and Steve, I'll begin with you, but Rob, you can answer this just as easily, and I'll twist reality for a moment. I won't let Nicolas Sarkozy do it all. Is it possible that the Palestinians have in some sort of way negotiated some opening with Hamas, and that they are carrying some sort of ability to bring Hamas to the table here, and that it's from Hamas's side that this is being driven?
Well, I would say two things. One is, first, you need the Palestinian Authority, in other words, President Mahmoud Abbas, to sign on for this, because if they're going to open the Rafah crossing, it would be under a 2005 agreement that he negotiated with the Egyptians and the Israelis that Hamas didn't, and Hamas wants control over that crossing, and no one wants to give it to them. So the PA is important to the end result. They have very little control over Hamas. Hamas has sent some people to Egypt from Damascus, which is where it's really run, to talk to Omar Suleiman, who's the Egyptian intelligence chief who's doing most of the negotiating. And Hamas is also interested in a ceasefire, but it also has its conditions too. And, you know, then we start a process of negotiating in a way through the Egyptians. The French have been helpful. The Americans are very involved to try to get to a ceasefire that is acceptable on both sides. But I suspect the Israelis will keep at least some of the military pressure up in the meantime.
You want to give us the last word, Rob?
I would only just say this, that, you know, in a way, whatever you think of President Sarkozy or whoever's doing the negotiating, the sort of fundamentals remain the same, don't they? And that is, for Israel to end this operation, it needs to be able to say, look, we stopped the rockets and we stopped the Hamas being able to rearm. Precisely what it is for Hamas to be able to come out of it without saying it was defeated is a bit less clear. But somehow, whatever ends this is going to have to meet those Israeli conditions.
And there's no sense that, from your perspective, Rob, that Israel has accomplished a military objective here? Or, you know, as the days go by, does this look more like a standoff to you?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what Steve thinks, but the impression I get is that the Israelis think that lessons have been learned from the war in 2006 in southern Lebanon, and that the military side of the operation is going as well or better than could be expected. The question is really, in a way, a bit more about the politics, and that is, if your aim is, as Israel has stated, to change the security situation in the south, do you achieve that by really fundamentally degrading Hamas, or just by something a bit less, which is making it clear to Hamas that the price for continued rocket fire is going to be pretty high and pretty painful?
All right. Thank you very much, Rob Watson, BBC defense correspondent. Since he raised it, Steve Erlanger, what do you think the political situation is from all of this, from where you're based in Jerusalem?
Well, Olmert, you know, there are elections here on February 10th, and two of the members of the cabinet are running against each other. Olmert's not running. So, and Barack Obama is going to get inaugurated before then. So whatever happens, I'm sure it'll be all done by the time Barack Obama gets into office. But I do believe what Rob said is quite right. Israel needs to be able to say that it's accomplished something lasting here.
And the rockets have stopped. We're going to leave it there, Steve. We've got to go, unfortunately, but thanks so much for joining us. Steve Erlanger of the New York Times joined us from Jerusalem on all the latest there on the ceasefire not announced by French President Sarkozy earlier this morning.
The topic to something far lighter. We're making a playlist, and we're looking for music that gets you in a good mood when you're facing bad financial times. And Jeffrey says to us, he wrote, "Money Makes the World Go Round" by the Broadway show Cabaret. He says it's very inspirational.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, of that we can be sure.
And Lloyd emailed us with just one word to pick his song, Faith.
Cause I gotta have faith.
So keep that conversation going and go to our website, thetakeaway.org, with your playlist suggestion. We're always on, and if you missed anything, take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.